Good morning. You're listening to KUNV 91.5, and this is Neon Eden. I'm your host, Patrick Kulikin. Read my columns at LasVegasSun.com and in the Las Vegas Sun, my co-host, as always, my Las Vegas Sun colleague, Tovin Lepan. The legislature is right in the middle of its every other year 120-day sprint, and there's lots of action happening up in Carson City. Joining us to talk about it, Andrew Doman from the Sun's Capital Bureau. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's start with the big news of the last week, which was NV Energy, our electricity monopoly. That's a story you've been all over. And tell us what NV Energy proposed what was proposed out of the Senate Commerce and Labor Committee last week.
So there was a little bit of chatter 2 weeks ago that there was some big announcement coming from NV Energy. And we didn't find out what that was until we obtained a copy of that on late Tuesday evening. And the general idea is to for the utility to get out of coal on an accelerated pace to close down most of the units of the Reed Gardner plant there in Clark County and invest more in natural gas and renewables.
And that's kind of a big deal because the utility has caught a lot of criticism over its coal plant, Reed Gardner, and the health effects there, right?
Right. They're facing a pending lawsuit. They faced ongoing criticism from U.S. Senator Harry Reid. So it is a big announcement that they're completely getting out of the coal business. Under this plan, in Clark County, at least, Reed Gardner would mostly be closed. Three out of the four units would be closed by the end of 2014.
And that's an accelerated pace from what they had been talking about.
Right. They've been talking about 2019.
Okay. So that's the top line news, which is a certainly a good story that I think everybody, at least on its face, sounds good. But the nitty gritty, I think, offers up plenty of reason to be skeptical. Now, I know you wrote a follow-up story, I think, last week, in which you talked to the consumer advocate in the Attorney General's office, the consumer advocate, an office that was designed to look after the public's interest in utility issues. What are their first thoughts about the plan?
Well, I think that the gist of the consumer advocate's, complaint really with the plan is that it comes in nice wrapping paper that NV Energy is going to invest in clean energy and bring jobs to Nevada. But he says that the plan will likely cause rates to go up considerably for ratepayers throughout Nevada. NV Energy does say that rates will go up, but they say not by much. Not much more than they already would on the current track. So that's his main criticism is that this plan, they're calling it Envision, that it'll lock in building and construction for the energy company for the next 10 years, which he says will drive up rates and won't let the company be as flexible.
Now, I imagine there's quite a bit of math to do yet. I mean, do we have any clue? About let's say my electricity bill is $100 in month of June this right now, what it would be under this plan versus what it would be if they did nothing, or is that just still to be determined?
Right. They said the company has said that rates are going to climb over the next 10 years anyway, but that this plan would be only 1% more. Add only 1% more.
1%
over that same time frame.
1% or 1 percentage point? Like, are rates going to go up 4% instead of 3%? Or 3% or 3.03%? You understand what I'm saying?
Right. I think it's the former there, but that's one thing that's still unclear about this is in the hearing last week, the governor's Office of Energy noted that we don't know what assumptions the energy company is putting in to get this number, to get this percent.
Uh-huh.
So without that data, because we know they're not using the data from their latest resource planning. So it's a little bit hard to say at this point what the true rate pact impact will be when we don't know what they're getting that number from.
And I feel like maybe I'm wrong here, but the utility capitalizes on the complexity and the opaque nature of these very complex issues.
I can tell you this: the utility, and I spoke with a few people on this who have sort of explained it to me this way: that the utility makes money from its rate base, and
yeah.
When it has a higher rate base, it's making more money. And that rate base really is reliant on construction.
Right. I want to get to that in a second. But
okay.
So Andrew, what about just the other interested players here and how they've reacted to the plan? I mean, what are we hearing from environmentalists, casinos, Harry Reid, our Senate Majority Leader?
Sure. So Harry Reid's office released a statement in support of the idea. The AFL-CIO, labor unions were on board with this because it creates short-term construction jobs. And then we've seen the Sierra Club and some environmental groups come out in support of this, although some of them have had a few caveats, a few concerns there. And you even saw the Moapa Band of Paiutes testify in support. And they're the ones who are suing the company over Reid Gardner.
Right, over the health effects there.
Right. Gaming companies, for instance, a lobbyist for MGM who testified that MGM uses 5% of the energy in Clark County, so a major energy user there, said that they're neutral so far. They haven't had time to unpack the amendment and see how it might affect them.
That's amazing. 5% of all the energy in Clark County is used by MGM casinos.
That's what they said on the record.
Wow. All right. So now you just alluded to this, but let's get back to it. You have a story today that gets at a very key point here. NV Energy is going to, they're going to shut down the coal plant and they're going to build a new natural gas and renewable capacity, right?
Right.
That's the deal. Now, when they build assets, that becomes part of the complicated formula by which they, it's determined how much they can charge us and how much they're allowed to profit. So just explain your story today a little bit.
Sure. And that's the basic idea. They build, they get to recoup that investment with a return on investment. So they make money off of that. So the idea of the story today is that basically the company doesn't need to go through the legislature to get out of coal and invest in renewables, a mix of renewables and natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
They could have done that yesterday. They could do it tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is there's an August 15th deadline they have to meet with the PUC to address Reid Gardner. I guess the idea, my understanding of the idea is that there's been so much controversy over this plant that they opened up a docket, they opened up a hearing about it. So they're already trying to come up with a plan of how to address the coal plant there in Clark County.
Mm-hmm.
This bill would sort of circumvent that process in a way that maybe the energy company would like to see.
They would like to lock in the whatever regulatory changes in the legislature rather than with the PUC.
Right, because their amendment
including
proposes,
rate increases, right? The rate increase.
Well, their amendment proposes that they construct or acquire or operate X amount of megawatts per year.
Uh-huh.
And then the PUC would either approve or modify that plan, but that all these investments shall be deemed prudent. So it seems as though, and this is what the consumer advocate has noted, that this sort of locks in a plan.
Right. It takes energy regulation in a significant way out of the hands of the PUC and puts it in the hands of the legislature. Why would the electricity monopoly want to do that? I have my own theory, but I'm interested to hear what people you talk to, what are they saying?
I think the way it was explained to me by the energy company, they want to Since this is such a major policy shift, they think it rises to the level that the legislature ought to decide, that the legislature is a policy-making body, and they ought to be the judges on this one. And the second point that the energy company made to me was that the PUC sets sort of the gives the paramount importance to rate minimum cost to ratepayers. And if this goes outside of the PUC and through the legislature has a little bit more flexibility in looking at other impacts of the plan, environmental impacts and things like that.
So they fear they wouldn't be able to get the rate increase through the PUC, but the legislature, they may be able to, because the legislature can consider that, oh, this would help our renewable energy industry, this would be better for the environment, et cetera.
Right. They might be able to, I guess what the energy company told me is that they're afraid that they wouldn't get the mix that they want in renewables and natural gas if they went to the PUC, and they sort of feel like they have a better shot getting that at the legislature.
Okay.
At least that's what they said to me in a conversation on Friday.
Right. Now, let me play cynic here, and maybe there's not a question here, but I'm wondering if you have any reaction to it. They have considerable resources, it seems to me, to influence the legislature. They're one of the largest campaign contributors in the state. Hundreds of thousands of dollars over the past three cycles, including key chair people, members such as Calvin Atkinson, who chairs Commerce and Labor. And they also have an army of lobbyists, and the ability to influence the legislative process may be better than the PUC, which is staffed with experts and takes its sweet time making decisions. Is there anybody up there doing that kind of political analysis?
Well, I guess I will say that the NV Energy does have 10. When you say an army, we can quantify that, and they have 10 lobbyists up here. Two of them work for the company, and then the utility, they've actually retained three different firms. So you have R&R Partners, the Ferraro Group, and Fenimore Craig Jones Vargas, who are all have some of their lobbyists are working for the utility.
And let's just make
a formidable force there,
right? Because R&R Partners CEO Billy Vassiliadis, longtime Democratic operative, and of course they're responsible for the What Happens Here campaign. Pete Ernott is their head of government affairs. He's very close to the governor. Greg Ferraro, also very close to the governor. You mentioned the Ferraro Group, and then the old Jones Vargas firm. That's where the governor had a, quote, job, unquote, while he was running for governor after he left the federal bench. So a formidable, as you say, a formidable front on the lobbying side.
But on the other side of that, though, you have a very competent administrator in the governor's Office of Energy, who is an expert on these matters and probably does have some influence as well.
Uh-huh. So you're suggesting they're not going to be able to just push through whatever they want on this.
I think the governor will have some advisors who are very, very knowledgeable about energy.
Okay. All right. Well, just fascinating. I mean, what's the timeline here? Are they going to kill the clock and then pass something in the last hour?
Well, if this goes through the normal process, the bill will have to clear out of committee by Friday. So they'll have to vote to adopt the amendment and then vote to in favor of the bill. And then that would go to a full vote in the Senate, and then it would sort of repeat the committee process over on the Assembly side.
Okay, that'll be fun to watch.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen the last of this.
All right, Andrew. And at the halfway point of sort of the session, where do we stand on issues? Some of the big issues that have come in terms of the gas tax, property taxes, and water in the PUC.
Well, we've had hearings on all those issues, and there's two gas tax proposals. One is from Senator Tick Sagerblum, who's from Vegas, and he says, "Okay, let's just raise the gas tax by a set amount every year for the next 10 years. I think it's the next 10 years. And then you have another option that the RTC in Southern Nevada is looking at, which would tie the gas tax in Clark County to inflation. So that means when the cost of highway construction goes up, the gas tax goes up with it. And that's a tricky little piece of legislation because it doesn't automatically raise the tax. It gives the Clark County Commission the choice to raise the tax.
You mean depending on the index? So let's say inflation is up 2%. They have the option of increasing the gas tax, or they don't have to if they don't want to?
I think it would go up
automatically
then, and they would have some chance to review it at a later time if it seems like it's getting out of control.
But the legislation just gives them the option at the forefront right away.
Right.
Okay.
And then on the property tax front, there's another bill, and this one's also... Oh, go ahead.
Let me ask first about the gas tax. Now, which proposal is more... Which one is in the driver's seat here?
That's hard to say. There were a lot of people who came out in support of the flat, just raising the gas tax.
Mm-hmm. That's about two cents per year for 10 years or something.
I believe that's correct.
Yeah,
but I think some industry groups are seeing that the state of our roads is not good, and they see this as a solution.
Mm-hmm.
The other RTC backed proposal is another way to get to the same problem, and it would just specifically be for Southern Nevada,
uh-huh,
for Clark County.
Okay. Now, you also wrote about property taxes. We have this super complicated system of property taxes. I think all three of us here, none of us own property, so this is totally irrelevant to us, as well as our listeners who are UNLV students.
Right.
But it is important. So what's the deal on property taxes?
There's a bill out there that could make property taxes go up, but it wouldn't just directly raise the rate there because they're already at the cap.
Mm-hmm.
What it would do is, right now, if you own a new home, it begins to depreciate. That's what they say. Over time, over 50 years, your property tax bill will maybe be lower than it otherwise would have been without depreciation. And this would decrease the depreciation factor,
mm-hmm,
which would basically mean that your property tax bill would be higher because you're not getting as much of a discount.
Right. Well, that makes sense because homes are built so much better now. No, I'm just kidding. That's not true.
I'm not going to go there.
All right. Although that actually is a good segue. We'll go to the next thing in a second here. This is Neon Eden. I'm Patrick Hooligan. My co-host is Tovin LePan. We're talking to Andrew Doman, who's up in Carson City in the Sun's Capital Bureau. And we're about halfway through the legislature. You also, I think, were at a construction defect hearing.
Right.
This is a sort of Groundhog Day legislation. Every 2 years, the construction firms... They believe that they're being harmed by frivolous lawsuits from homeowners who are sort of drummed into these lawsuits by plaintiff attorneys. Tell us about that.
So this is a bill from Senate Minority Leader Michael Roberson, who's a Republican from Henderson, and he's made this one of his main issues this session. He's going to carry the torch on this, and you're right, it has been something that... seems to come back every session, but his general idea is that he'd like to see some way to get to have fewer lawsuits. The builders say they're really the economic recovery is being stalled because of lawsuits and the higher insurance premiums that builders have to pay because of the lawsuits. On the flip side, trial lawyers say that they're standing up for homeowners who can't get any relief from some bad builders out there who won't reply and won't repair construction defects to their homes, even though they're required to by warranty. So there's really two sides to this, and the homeowner's kind of caught in the middle.
Right. Is there any way out of this morass of every other session? I mean, is there a compromise? Is anybody talking about what might be the end game here, or are we just going to come back in 2 years and do the same thing?
Again, Senator Roberson has made this one of his prime objectives to get something done on this session. It all stems from these defects that homeowners have. So I guess the easiest fix would just be if homes didn't have these defects, or they were repaired in a timely and cost-effective manner, and the problem wouldn't materialize at all. But as in terms of a legislative solution, I guess we'll have to see what Senator Roberson can do.
Uh-huh.
And what compromises he'll ultimately need to make to get everyone on board for passage of a bill.
Does it seem like he's going to use this as a bargaining chip on stuff that Democrats want?
He may.
It's a high priority. All right.
Yeah.
Speaking of Roberson, he would like water rate increases to go before the PUC. There was a hearing on that last week, wasn't there?
There was, right. So the general idea on that is there was a rate increase last summer, and some people, especially some smaller businesses, weren't too happy about that because they now have to pay for their fire lines, which essentially is a big water pipe that comes into their buildings in event of a fire.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah, there were significant increases for some kind of small and medium-sized commercial customers.
Right.
Whereas homeowners and large customers, i.e. the Las Vegas Strip, were held harmless. And this really angered a lot of people here in a lot of the kind of Chamber of Commerce crowd and the commercial developer crowd. And so they're really kind of trying to stick it to Pat Mulroy, the head of the Water Authority here. Did you happen to be at that hearing on last week?
I was not. I was at another hearing, but I did sit down and talk to Pat Mulroy and to Senator Roberson about this bill earlier. And from the senator's perspective, I think he's sort of saying elected officials who currently make the decision now, the local elected officials there in Clark County, they're not water policy experts. So his idea is to get some real water quality experts or water rate experts in on making the decision and bring some more equity to the process.
Uh-huh.
Rates are likely going up again in 2016, so this has some real life impact here.
Right.
Who makes that call?
Right, because the Water Authority is going to be very short of money.
Right.
It already is. It's sort of the opposite in a way. He wants to take water policy out of the hands of the legislative body and the elected officials on the water board and put it in the hands of the PUC, whereas NV Energy wants to take energy policy out of the hands of the PUC and put it in the hands of the elected officials. That's sort of an interesting contrast.
Right. I hadn't thought of that, but that does appear to be what's going on.
And Mulroy, what's her response? Or the Water Authority. I don't know if you talked to her, but
she said I sat down with her at the legislature the other day, and she's saying basically that this would be unconstitutional because it would disrupt current contracts that they have with bondholders, and B, that the local officials are the best ones to make local decisions, and if the Senator Roberson is concerned about transparency and how this process moves forward in terms of rate making, then she'll do all she can to have a much more transparent and public process. But she doesn't want the underlying system to change.
Uh-huh. It should be a transparent process in the hands of her hand-selected puppets. I'm sorry. I'm just editorializing there. Okay. Another issue, Tovin, you actually wrote about this, driving privileges.
Yes. Senate leader Mo Dennis and Ruben Kiwin are sort of leading the charge on this, and they've brought it up, the bill. And basically it's based on a Utah law back, I think, in maybe 1999. They started offering licenses to people who aren't in the country legally or can't, you know, otherwise prove a sort of legal residency status along with their identity. And then 2004, they sort of expanded to this driver's privilege, which is sort of what we talk about now and is what they're calling it here in Nevada. And so basically it just means that before you could not go and get a driver's license if with just a foreign passport or a foreign birth certificate. You had to have more ID than that. It's part of the Real ID Act, which isn't fully enforced yet, but the U.S. government wants all licenses that you would use, say, to board a plane to be the same and have certain requirements, and you have certain requirements to get that. So you can't give them a license if you're going to comply with this Real ID Act. And so now people who are in the country illegally, or maybe people who don't have their birth certificate, or, you know, some people who are here legally and just for some reason cannot go through the requirements to get a license will be able to get one. And the opponents or the proponents say that this will allow people to get insurance. A lot of people drive now without insurance. They drive anyways, they're saying. They get in accidents and then they flee the scene of the crime. Some people get in the accidents and then they stay, but then they have tickets. You know, if you're driving without a license, driving without insurance, we're talking about thousands of dollars in tickets at this point. And so they say it'll make the roads safer. People are doing it anyways. And while the opponents say that we shouldn't be encouraging illegal immigration and allowing people more privileges that will encourage them to stay in Nevada.
Do you know, is there any sense up there for this is going to sail through?
I know it has bipartisan support. So it's definitely an idea that I think resides a little bit more in the Democratic camp, but it does have some Republican support.
And you can
ultimately
see,
I think the governor's position is going to be really important on a bill like this.
Right. And go ahead.
I was just going to say, in the transportation hearing, while I have heard some rumblings of there's some opposition, but Andrew's right, there is bipartisan support. It does seem like it's got a lot of backing. And in the transportation hearing last week that I watched, no one objected to it in the public. In fact, the leader was asking for people to come up and object, and nobody was there to object in either Las Vegas or Carson City.
And it seems to me the governor facing re-election in 2014 does not want to face the kind of wave of Latino opposition that has faced Republican candidates in recent elections. So this would be a way to at least garner a little bit of better Latino support than Republicans traditionally have. So it seems like it has a good shot. Andrew Doman from the Sun Capital Bureau, thanks so much for joining us. We're going to bring you back in a few weeks if you will indulge us.
All right. Thank you, Patrick and Tobin.
See ya. You've been listening to Neon Eden. I'm Patrick Kulik and my co-host Tobin Lepan. Our producer is Steven Zeller. We'll catch you next week on KUNV 91.5.